Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
I thought we could stop talking about this guy a long time ago, but apparently not. Brian Koberger now says, it wasn't me. It was somebody else. It wasn't me. I've been railroaded. My attorney sucked. And he's looking for the last lever to pull, and he has essentially pulled it. Brian Koberger, as you may remember, stood in an Ada County courtroom and said the word guilty four separate times, one for each of the University of Idaho students he admitted taking the lives of. 13 months later, he's now filed to take it all back. And somehow in his mind, he thinks that just writing this out on a piece of paper and calling the New York Times is what's going to do it. Well, we're certainly talking about it, aren't we? Whether or not that actually means anything legally is a whole other conversation. Writing that his actual innocence is his truth. His truth. I love it when people have their truths. Joining us to break all of this down, psychotherapist Siobhan Scott, who spent her career inside how people build and rebuild the stories they tell about themselves. And that sentence is where we are starting. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Also with us, hi, I'm Tony. I'm a podcaster. That's my credentials.
I just love Siobhan on Wednesdays. Yeah. she wraps us in the greatest blanket of understanding of others.
So do I. This is one of my favorite, one of my most favorite conversations of the week.
And we need her today for the darkness we're covering. Thank God we're covering Koberger first. Give us a little lightness of idiocy and some jocularity from the moron he is before we move on to horrendous pain.
Obviously, it's all horrendous pain. But at this point, Koberger is almost just laughable with the things that come out of his mouth. It's like if there's anything left out of this, it's comic relief from an idiot. And in a little bit, we're also going to talk about Lindsey Clancy as well and where that case is at in the trial, and it will bring us all down before we continue our day.
Yeah, most of these cases, we always got to make sure we give props and compassion to the victims of Koberger, right? But 1,000%. At the same time, though, and he kind of grabbed the spotlight, and you mentioned this in one of your pieces, Tony, from the streaming that was coming out talking about the victims. But I do like that he's putting himself back up there for the Gonsalveses to go at him again, because anytime they can take some swings at him, I think it's good.
he kind of put a string back on his head and put on the pinata costume and went back up. It's like, okay. Like
you take it on the wrong family, brother.
Yeah. Let's look at how he worded it, because, this is not necessarily, we're not talking about the legalities or anything. We're talking about the brain behind this, how he got to calling the New York Times and writing this letter. That's what I'm really curious about. He wrote that his actual innocence is his truth. That's part of the verbiage that he used, and all sorts of verbiage, and we'll get into that in a little bit too. That's a man building a room to stand in. So which are we dealing with here, Siobhan? A liar that's trying to run a play on this? Or is this a man who has genuinely rewritten the file in his own head, and he believes that he didn't do this?
could be some of both. I seriously doubt that he has convinced himself he didn't do it. But my guess is he's crafting a story that makes him feel better about himself. And it's obviously BS. But in some way, it allows him some sense of comfort, some sense of, well, it wasn't really my fault I did it, or you know, these other factors weren't looked at. And, you know, of course, to those of us who can look at the objective truth, that's absurd, but it's all self-serving. You know, the guy is hyper-focused on details. We know that he had all these obsessive tendencies. And is he trying to pull that in? Because it gives him a sense of control. And he does, clearly, being locked up the way he is, he doesn't have a lot of control over things. Mm-hmm. And so this is meeting some kind of psychological need for him to feel important, to be in control again. And it gets him attention, which, you know, these kind of guys love attention.
Except from his cellmates. Yeah. Siobhan, what I'm curious about, if this plays into it at all with his, again, we don't know because we haven't seen any kind of testing or anything, but he's got the observable behaviors and traits of high levels of psychopathy. I think you agreed with that. I'm curious because we've seen so many things he's done throughout the course of the trial, the things we learned about him before that. This individual is an extreme copycat. You know, he studied all the serial killers before. It looks like a lot of the methods, tools, and techniques he used were copied from others. That's why we even came up with our theory that he secreted his, made a cache of his things he used afterwards and probably had it secreted before as well, you know, copying other serial killers that did that before. So my conjecture on this, and I'm curious your thoughts on it, was this letter that was written, and he's been noted before of being a horrendous writer. He's not a good writer. And I'm curious if that's because he's got a bad memory, because he seems to like consume information and try to regurgitate it. Because he really, I haven't seen him, I'm curious if you've seen him, have an original thought. He seems to take in information and try to regurgitate it back out, but he does such a horrible job at it. I really think that's why he's such a bad writer, because he can't remember things very well. Because this kind of goes to everyone says, you know, oh, he was, you know, he's a smart guy, he's a PhD. No, I think he's a horrendous, individual. I don't think he's got any intelligence. I think he just had a lot of obsessive compulsive behavior that allowed him to do okay enough to keep moving on. But yeah. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, I think that's a really good supposition. There's a lot of copying going on and copying other people. He's not an original thinker in any way. He's role-playing in essence. Mm-hmm. And I think, yes, definitely we can use the word psychopath. And we can also use the word, he's either, you know, they threw out the diagnosis of autistic, that would fit, but also schizoid personality would fit, which is a different but similar kind of diagnosis, which can make someone come off very weird and idiosyncratic. So yeah, I think the copying and not integrating with the whole piece, you know, because it's just you're getting bits and pieces of stories from him. What story is he latching onto now?
It's even like his writing. Like his writing is very disjointed, like you said. It's bits and pieces that he's kind of remembering and thinking he's got to put it here. He's trying to mirror and copy what he thinks it needs to be because he heard it someplace and he's making it here. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And we're gonna. I'm trying to keep track. I got to make a Siobhan dictionary of all the cool words you come up with.
Well, I mean, there's a lot. I have a lot of questions here. I mean, and there's a couple points you made there, Robin. I want to point to of him copying things, because the first thing I thought of, like, oh, who's he copying this round? Where he's making this, it wasn't me. I've started to look, and there's a litany. I mean, there's a laundry list of people who've pled guilty and then tried to take it back, or have been convicted and tried to take it back. That's nothing new. But what I found kind of striking in the writing of this document that he threw up into the world, he uses the words broken plea, which is the title of the one book that came out that is filled with misinformation and unchecked facts and just a bunch of shit. It was a really not well done book, in my opinion. But clearly he latched onto it because it's the one piece of writing that came out that was in his corner, and the pro burgers could go, "Ooh, this is something." That I found very interesting, that he's latching onto someone else's narrative and going, "Oh, I'm going to go down this road." So that was very funny. But you have all the words to describe him, you know, psychopathic, schizoid personality. What do you call the folks who look at all the evidence against Brian Koberger, the stunning amount of evidence against Brian Koberger? They don't absorb any of it. They find excuses for it, or they just don't absorb the extent of the truth. They just kind of stop at certain facts and don't take in the rest. And then they say, "See, this is proof of something." No, you just didn't take in the rest of their information. Mm-hmm. What do you call those folks? Is there a name for that?
Flat earthers. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, you're right up there. I mean, are they that different than Brian Koberger, I guess?
Yeah, the first thought that comes to my mind is deluded and driven by emotion. And I've often called folks that latch on to people like this, it's almost like they're basking in the dark glow, you know? They get a sense of importance.
Basking in the dark glow.
Yeah. Because, you know, when people have their heroes, wonderful people in the world, they kind of attach to them. They follow them all the time. They write them letters. And they're kind of basking in the glow of the famous person. I have a connection to them. But this is people who are attracted to this dark side and attracted to the dark glow. You know, there are still communities online with young people who have latched on to the Columbine killers and are saying that, you know, they were victims and it's all justified and aggrandizing them and falling in love with them. When it's the women who fall in love with them, if we want to call it love, right, they develop this bizarre attachment. We even have a term for it, hybristophilia. And these
say that word again, Siobhan.
Hybristophilia. H-A-I-B-R-I-S-T-O-P-H-I-L-I-A.
Hybristophilia.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Your brain's so big.
I'm gonna start using that in sentences.
I actually had that one taped to my monitor for a long time because I wanted to integrate spelling it right.
I just keep adding more stickies all over mine.
Yeah.
You should do a spelling contest and who can spell that correctly.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be fun, a forensic spelling contest, right?
Here's the weird thing I'm encountering with the Brian Koberger case. In my normal life of people that there's people in my world that I trust that seem to have you know, education, living a normal, healthy life for the most part, as far as I can tell. But I've heard from some people, one of them a psychotherapist, that, you know, they believe Koberger is innocent. They give me the laundry list of why they think he's innocent. I can easily debunk 95% of the points that are made. But I've seen someone that has gone as far as writing Brian Koberger, a psychotherapist. Writing Brian Koberger, believing in his innocence, and that there's a voice out there for him, or there's people out there that believe in him. What the hell is that?
What the hell?
What the hell is that?
I would love to have a conversation with a therapist who thinks that way.
I'll hook you up if you want.
Please do.
My reaction was, and you used to manage my meds, and they no longer do.
Explains a lot.
That horrifies me. That really
it horrified
does.
Me when I had the guy. I'm like, what? Like, wow.
And when Tony had hair, and then all of a sudden his hair is
gone. I blame that. But I mean, there's a lot of people out there like that. I mean, and I'm not trying to say it, you know, insultingly, but it's some of the folks who are thinking that he's innocent or that he's somehow been railroaded. I mean, they're not necessarily the tinfoil wearing hat people. I mean, that you typically see on things like this. What is that? Is that because there's more of a community environment that exists in our world today, and it's easier for people who are not going to do the research themselves, just to kind of fall into and jump into that narrative that otherwise, you know, wouldn't, where it just used to be kind of tinfoil wearing hat people over here. What is that? Why is it that you have seemingly healthy thinking, normal folks in every other aspect of life somehow feeling like this about this case?
It's open to speculation. The only thing I can guess is that, you know, they may do a really adequate job of masking their bizarre thoughts.
True.
And smart people can have really strange, I mean, we still have MDs who come out and say COVID wasn't a real thing, you know, and yet they're practicing medicine. And, you know, despite all the evidence and all the people who died from it, you know, you can find people who appear to be normal and high functioning, but they've got, we can just say, some screws loose inside.
Yeah. Can some of that happen because, I mean, when people get triggered from traumatic events earlier in life and you have trauma responses, can some of these things be from trauma responses earlier in life that they just can't seem to overcome or are unaware of? And part of it also then be like we've been talking about, the notoriety part of it is like, hey, look, I'm going to get attention because, you know, I'm saying goofy things or I'm aligning myself with someone horrendous and I'm going to stand on this hill and die because it's so righteous, even though it might not matter so much about the hill they're on. They're just seeing them on the hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there could be trauma. There could be personality factors. It could be that they have something in the past where they were accused of something that they didn't do. And so they're kind of projecting out there and seeing, you know, that they're always going to go for the underdog, or they may have a fantasy of saving him in some way. It would be a really interesting book to write, you know, interview, in-depth interviews with those folks and try to get into what's going on in here.
Yeah, because I've done stuff like that on people that try to shine up to the serial killers behind bars. I know they've interviewed a lot of them and or look at the research behind it. But even just people that kind of support, you know, on the peripheries without even getting that close, that just subscribe. Again, the only thing I can think of is, that's why it popped in my mind, is flat earthers, man. I mean, there's just a group of people that refuse to accept evidence at face value and just will dismiss it. Again, such massive levels of confirmation bias is just unbelievable.
Is that refusal, though, Siobhan, or is that incapability?
That's another good question.
Yeah, good question. It may be both, depending on the person. And some people really have this thing about the underdog and that the system is out to get people. And this may come from their own history in some way. And this sense of, I've got to rescue people who have been victimized. So.
Sure. And at its core, that's a good thing, to help people that have been victimized, but not everybody's a victim.
No.
That's the thing. And a lot of people will play the victim card to get sympathy and empathy from people who are too readily available to dish out that empathy. And once you get burned so many times, you learn. But I guess maybe there's just some people who haven't been burned enough and they're still dishing it out.
Yeah.
You know, and with too big of a spoon.
And misplaced empathy is predominant, I think, in certain portions of the culture. You know, I read a lot of stuff, and sometimes from other clinicians who are saying every serial killer has been an abuse victim. Not true. Not true.
Yeah.
I don't believe Brian Koberger as a child. I don't believe his parents were abusive.
No, I don't think so either.
Did he get teased in school? Sure. But most of us have red hair. You get tortured in school, right?
Mm-hmm. Boys with the name Robin, yes.
Yeah, I'll bet. See? And I don't think that accounts. I don't think it makes current sense with what we know, that every person, you know, the old saying, hurt people hurt people. No, sometimes psychopaths who were born that way hurt people. And it's misplaced empathy. And I find myself online having that argument a lot with people who just don't get it.
It's interesting, Siobhan, because as we're talking about it, what popped in my head is so I'm going to go glass half full on people like this, because they are full of empathy. They want to help. They want to be there for someone that was disenfranchised from their context. But what they seem to lack is an ability to have discernment. you know, because empathy plus action is compassion, and that's what they're trying to do. But misplaced empathy, like you said, is a lack of this being able to discern who actually is broken and who is actually, you know, deserving of your compassion. Right. You know, so how does someone not develop discernment, I guess, at some point in life?
I think it's a combination of just consuming bad information, you know, pop culture information, and not looking deeper. I often find that when I point out more data that there's a lot I could talk about all that, but just the gist of it is that we have a lot of bad information bopping around the culture, and people may read and they read it over and over again and they just swallow it. They don't look deeper and they don't know how to look deeper.
Right. Or want to.
I want to talk a little bit about the verbiage in the letter. He called the state's case a myopic narrative work of fiction. He pulled out the thesaurus from the prison library. He wrote that justice was circumnavigated. I don't think that's the right word to use in that sentence. This is a criminology PhD writing about his own murder conviction. And he's reaching, like I said, for the prison thesaurus. That vocabulary in his whole letter, if you read the whole damn thing, it's just filled with like, ooh, this will be a word. Like he went on spell check and put it like on Max. The vocabulary that he's using in this thing, what does that tell you about what he's getting out of this writing, why he's writing that way, who he's writing to? What did you see? What was your reaction to that letter?
Yeah, look how smart and superior I am. You know, I'm going to use these million-dollar words that none of you are going to understand. And again, I'm above everybody. And it also lets me know, how did he talk his way into a PhD program? You know, because they love the verbiage like that. And that says a lot about him and how he's bumped himself up in the academia. Yeah.
And he hasn't gotten any better. I remember at some point we've seen his writing samples from before, or I don't know if we actually saw his writing samples, but we saw and we also saw the notes he made on students' papers as well.
Yeah.
It's just like this. It's a word salad of words that he's trying to piece together because he just can't communicate as a human being. Because again, using that word human being in him, it's incongruent. There's no human in there. It is a conglomeration of, as I said before, of genetic goo, because it's just nothing's coming together to be able to communicate as a human being communicates. It just is, and this is just another writing sample of it. It just, his arc is flat. You know, we talk about life arcs. I do a lot of time, I know, and I always say pass is prologue with a lot of people. And I've been told, you know, well, we're different today than we are yesterday. And yes, everyone is on a path of learning. Some people are parabolic, some people are flat, you know, but still linear, you know, going upwards. He is flat. There's no new data. There's no new growth going on in there. This is because the way he was a couple years ago is the way he is now. This is just completely lack of anything. I mean, he's still battling for better bananas like he was when he was 5 years old, it looks like.
It's nuts. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue this conversation. Those links are in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
In light of Brian Koberger now coming out and saying that he didn't do it and that his family has stood by him this whole time, I think it's time to address his family. And I'm going to try and do this as respectfully as possible because you didn't ask for this. You got thrown into this situation by your broken-brained son. And you've been unfortunately along for the ride thus far. What I want to tell you in as lovingly critical, as in a lovingly critical way as I can, it's okay to let him go. And maybe you already have in some ways, but in others you haven't, because we saw the receipts. I see the receipts. I saw the receipt of you putting mom $150 in Brian's commissary account every damn week. Helping little Brian get his snacks. You need to stop doing that. You don't need to keep feeding the monster. Your son did this. Why are you still supporting him? It's not healthy for you. It's not healthy for him. It's not healthy for anybody. There's no way of working through this where this is the best route of continued existence, standing by your little boy no matter what. No, it's not. It's not. And we're going to talk about this. And I wrote this. This is just kind of an open letter. And like I said, I want to deliver this respectfully. But I got to say, in reality, seeing that receipt and seeing your name, Mary, next to $150 that you're dropping into his commissary account on a weekly basis is a little sickening, considering we know what your son did and that you still have the gall to stand behind him, even if it is just to buy him ramen and Snickers. There is a time for letting go of anything and everyone and everything, depending on what they do and how they do it. And I got to say, Lil Bry's checked every damn box. Why you're still there supporting him might be part of the reason why Brian became the monster he did. It's time to change course. You were right about him once. That matters. And nobody gets to take that from you. In 2020, the word your family used was proud. Melissa said it out loud to the Times, and she meant it. Brian had come through the other side of something terrible, and your family had pulled him there. By your very own hands, helped him get through it. Two parents, two sisters, years of work, money spent, love pointed in every direction available, rehab, boxing, running, community college first, then a bachelor's degree, then a master's, then a doctoral program, 1,300 miles from home in Washington State. You earned that word, honestly. This letter isn't here to tell you that you were wrong. You weren't. Not about the addiction, not about the work he'd put in, not about the young man standing in front of you at that particular point in his life. Everything you saw was real, and everything you did mattered. It just never reached what was ever underneath. Because nothing anyone has ever done has gotten near that. Mrs. Koberger, you got on a plane to Boise and sat in a courtroom while four families stood up and said out loud what your son did to their children, every word of it, with you right there in the gallery. That's not a small thing to survive. Most people couldn't, and nobody should have to. Amanda, you were there too. You sat through it with her. Melissa, you stayed on the East Coast because your father was having heart trouble, and the fact that you had planned to be there says everything about the kind of family you are. Then Judge Hippler handed down four consecutive life terms plus 10 years, and it was over. Your son stood up and walked out past his mother without even looking at her. He didn't say anything. He didn't turn his head. That was the last thing he did in that room. And the last thing you got from him, and it was the back of his head going through a door. You already knew what he was capable of doing to the people closest to him. Not the worst of it, but the shape of it. Let's go back to February 8th of 2014. Brian was 19, a few days out of a rehab center back home in Pennsylvania. He took Melissa's phone. Roughly $400 is what it cost at that point in time. He paid a friend $20 to drive him to a mall and sold it to an automated kiosk for $200. Run the numbers on that because you lived them. He destroyed $400 of his sister's property to put $180 in his own pocket. That's not a scheme. And it isn't clever. It's somebody who ran the math and what it cost her and decided the numbers didn't matter. It only mattered what mattered to him, that he got something out of it. Your husband found out and your husband called the police on his own son. Misdemeanor theft. Brian served no time because Monroe County runs a diversion program that erases the first charge once probation's finished. And that's where the case went. Police later confirmed the record no longer exists. The system itself gave him a clean slate. You did what a lot of parents wouldn't do, turn your kid in. And good on you for that. I want you to think about what that decision actually required, because you were there for it. Somebody in your house had to pick up a phone. Somebody had to give a police officer the name of their own kid out loud, knowing what it starts. Then everybody in that house had to keep living while it played out. There's one line of that police report that reads differently now than it did then. When his father confronted him about the phone, Brian told him not to do anything stupid. 19 years old, days out of rehab, sleeping in his father's house, eating his father's food, wearing clothes his father paid for. And the instinct wasn't shame. It wasn't an apology. And it wasn't an offer to fix it. It was a warning aimed at the man who took him back in. And then your family fixed him anyway. You reported it. And then you went to work, all of you, and it worked. That's not a punchline. The addiction actually went away. What came out the other side was a functioning adult somewhat with 2 degrees and a doctoral program ahead of him. By every measure available to your family at the time, you had won. You took a 19-year-old selling a stolen phone at a mall kiosk and turned him into a graduate student. You should know that what you did during those years is one of the most remarkable things a family can do. The fact that it wasn't enough doesn't make it small. It makes it tragic. And none of it was your fault. So look at what's come back at you since. Where Brian was held in jail, you were on video calls with him for hours at a time, every day, hours of your life on a screen, day after day, for months on end. Nobody ordered that. No court required it. You did it because he is your son and he is in a cell and you could not stop being his mother just because of what put him there. Or could you? Maybe you should have. Maybe there is, or there shouldn't be, an unconditional love when people do that level of heinous crime. I can't say. I'm not in your shoes. I don't know exactly how I would handle something like that. I like to think I know, but I'm not you, and I've never been confronted with the madness that you have to confront every day that you open your eyes. Melissa, you kept annual reminders in your calendar for each of the 4 victims' birthdays. You told the Times your mother prays every day for those families. You left a job because your employer got buried in inquiries about the name. You also said that if you'd ever had a reason to believe your brother did this, you'd have turned him in yourself. Good on you. And on his most recent birthday behind bars, Brian asked you to bake a cake to his eldest sister's taste and to have her blow out the candles. A birthday request routed home from prison in Ohio with instructions attached. He's in a cell. He's asking you to do things, specific things designed to his specifications on his timeline, even from behind reinforced glass. He's still issuing directions and you are asked to follow them. None of that brought you a phone call before he blew it all up again. Because on July 27th of 2026, Brian filed a handwritten petition for post-conviction relief in Ada County District Court. He's representing himself. He's alleging he was coerced, that false promises were made, that exculpatory evidence was withheld, and he was convicted and convinced to falsely confess. He calls the state account of the murders work of fiction. That petition names Ann Taylor, Elizabeth Massoff, and Mbika Barlow, court-appointed attorneys, who spent more than 2 years on his case and kept him off Idaho's death row. By any standard you want to use, that is the most valuable thing anyone has ever done for your son. They finished doing it, and he put their names in a court document and called their work ineffective. He also didn't tell you first. He called a newspaper. A reporter at the New York Times knew before the woman who sat through those impact statements did. Your family found out the way strangers did, off a headline on a Monday. Let's be precise about what that petition produces for him at minimum, no matter how a judge eventually rules on it. A hearing? A ride out of his cell? A room with other people in it? A camera? Probably several of them, if it goes that far. He's a man in maximum security south of Boise, in a building where the days are engineered to be identical, and he found one lever still connected to anything outside those walls, and he pulled it. He's also asking the court to appoint him a new attorney. The claim is that his lawyers ruined him. And the remedy he's requesting is another lawyer paid for by the same state of Idaho he says manufactured the case against him. Set that next to a stolen phone in 2014 and a warning not to do anything stupid. 11 years apart, and the reflex is identical. Whoever's standing closest to him is a lever, and levers get pulled. I know we'd say to all of this, some of you are already saying it. He's your son. He's your brother. That's not a position you adopted. It's a fact. And facts like that don't come with an exit clause. They are parents and siblings. And there are parents and siblings all over the world right now dealing with someone who's put them through hell. And every one of them already knows the answer. You don't quit on your child. You don't quit on your brother. And look, the instinct is decent. It is right 9 out of 10 times. And a world without it would be a worse place to live in. So I'm not telling you to stop loving him, although maybe I am. Nobody hands down that instruction from the outside, but maybe more people should. But the reality is, I'm not in your chair. I haven't been for a single day. So I cannot honestly say how you feel. But here's what I'm asking you to consider. And it's narrower than that, and it's harder. That instinct you're following assumes there's somebody still in there for the love to reach. It assumes the door you're holding open leads somewhere other than just consumption of whatever goodness you have. No one on the outside looks at that and goes, oh, good parents, good sisters. And it doesn't matter. I know you're not doing that for the outside world. You're probably doing it for yourself, and you're doing it for the person that you hope Brian is. It assumes the person on the other side of it can be gotten to if you just keep the light on long enough and don't give up first. Your family already ran that test. You ran it under the best conditions anybody could have asked for. Two parents, two sisters, money spent, years given, a 19-year-old put back together piece by piece by people who wanted it to work more than they wanted anything in their lives. And what came back through that door was a man with 2 degrees who did what was done in Moscow, Idaho, who admitted it under oath, who then filed a document blaming his lawyers for it and called a reporter before he called his mother. Melissa, you already said the truest sentence anyone connected to this case has said out loud. You told the Times, it's confusing, it's painful, it's like being victimized but not really being a victim. That's not a woman asking permission to keep loving her brother. That's a woman describing what it costs her to do it. And that price is real. So I want to say plainly what letting go would actually look like, because the caricature of it is a cruelty that nobody is proposing. Nobody is asking you to hold a press conference. Nobody's asking for a statement or a denunciation or a performance for the people watching. That's not what this is. Although it probably would help maybe to say out loud publicly so he can see it too, that you're done, that there's no more feeding the beast of the baby you probably wish you would have aborted. It's quieter than that. It's not taking the call. It's not making the drive. It's a birthday that goes by without a cake baked to anyone's specifications. It's the four of you deciding that whatever you owed, you've paid, and the account is closed. It means accepting that the person you rebuilt is not the person who filed that petition from a prison cell, and that no amount of holding on will turn him into the man you thought you'd made. No more deposits in his commissary. Letting go doesn't cost your family its decency. It doesn't erase those 11 years of work. It doesn't take back the word proud. You earned it. It's yours. Grief over a person who's still breathing is still grief, and setting it down is not the same thing as pretending it never happened. What it cost him is an audience, and that is the only currency Brian has ever actually spent. Madison Mogan was 21 years old. Kaylee Gonzalez was 21. Zanna Kernodle, 20. Ethan Chapin was 20. Their families never got a choice about any of this. Not one piece of it. Not one day of it. Not then and not now. They will carry those names for the rest of their lives, and nothing will ever make that weight lighter. So tell me how it makes sense that you open up your checkbook and give your little boy $150 every week so he can get snacks after he butchered all four of those children. And you're giving him snack time? I'm sorry, someone needs to say it. It's not right. You need to stop. You have a choice here. Those families have no choice of what they can do or not do with their children. Their children are gone because of yours. And every week you're still making the choice to fill his bowl with food like an injured stray dog in the wild that keeps coming back with rabies and biting the people in the neighborhood, killing them. And what you're doing is like, come here, boy. Let's keep you going. So you can do more. At some point, there is a level of responsibility that falls onto you. Enabling, validating, giving breath and life to the monster that is Brian Koberger. It's up to you how history remembers you. For who you are, what you've accomplished in your life outside of Brian Koberger, the victim of being the parent of Brian Koberger, or the continued enabler of Brian Koberger to your dying day. It's your choice how you want to be remembered. Choose wisely. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue it right there. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey, everybody. Lady Luck here. And we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. and there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love, with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com, SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, Lady Luck?
Bretzky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just $10.
$10 for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love, with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com, SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.